Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. We welcome to the studios of CBS Interactive Liquid Ideas boss Stuart Greger.
G'day, Tim.
Mumbrella Deputy Editor Robin Hicks.
Hi, Tim.
And podcast producer Alice Terlikovsky.
Hi, Tim.
This week,
the news of the world phone hacking scandals, Australian connection.
ANZ and Westpac launch new TV ads.
Reality Bites 10, 7 and 9 continue ratings race.
Welcome along to the podcast, Stuart. It shocks me that it's been this long, but I don't think we've yet had you on the podcast, have we?
Look, it's hard to believe.
We've had you on other stuff. You've taken part in Mumbrella Question Times. You've taken part in Mumbrella 360.
I famously did Mumbrella Question Time last year, and you stitched me up by my off-the-cuff quote that all advertising people were backslapping knob jockeys, and I've had 12 months of slanderous communication with the advertising industry since then. Yeah, Mumbrella 360, which I commendation to you guys. I thought it was a sensational couple of days. I really think it was worth doing and worth doing really well. I hope you do it again.
Well, you are very kind. Now, you curated one
of
those.
I'm in PR, though. Of course, I'm going to talk you guys up, talk me up. That's the gig.
That's the gig, indeed. Now, you curated the six things wrong with PR and how to fix them session. Let's try and actually recap
what the six things were.
Yeah. Look, now, one of the more intriguing ones, which actually, because it was only a 45-minute session, you didn't get much time to cover, was the problem of too many POMs in PR. So let's start with that one, shall we?
Nah, look, this feels like a stitch up. I'll be honest with you. Look, one of the things that I was that we were hoping to talk about at the start of in that session, which to some degree got hijacked by what a lot of sessions about what's wrong with PR, and which is by the measurement issue, which is how do you measure the success of public relations
campaigns. And
we'll
come to that in a minute, yeah.
So kind of that took 30 of the 45 minutes, I think. But, yeah, the POM thing was a little bit facetious because I knew there were going to be a couple of POMs on the panel, obviously. And one of the issues that we were just contending with is the skills with PR, which is based around relationships and really close relationships with the media and the influencers within a market, is that as easily transferable as you know, creative advertising or even media buying is, where it's not so much the relationships as it is the skill set. You know, my contention was that it's a little bit harder to move straight into a PR role rather than it would be into a sort of a media buying role or even an advertising creative role, where one, you can be working on the same brands if you're, you know, in the advertising world, just a new market. And there is, of course, certain local knowledge you need. But my contention was that it's, you know, a lot of what we do is based on relationships that have been built over 10, 15, 20 years. You know, I've been in the media since 1987. So, you know, I was just trying to have a bit of a crack at the POMs. It's a fair game. It's sport.
Now, my question, I suppose my...
Kind of a go at the Queenslanders.
Yeah, I suppose my kind of question is, do you say you had the choice between hiring someone, you know, I don't know, a kind of medium weight role, where your choice is between someone who maybe hasn't got much experience in the particular part of the PR world that you deal with, which is that sort of specialist, you know, nice lifestyle
yes.
brands, etc. But maybe, you know, maybe is from Australia, so knows the landscape a bit, versus someone who has specialised in that subject area in a different country. A year down the line, who do you think would be performing best for you?
Look, I'll be honest, the account director I employed only, you know, 6 weeks ago is a POM, but she's been here four years, so I think she's, you know, de facto Australian and that sort of stuff. The answer is the person is the best cultural fit and who I reckon looks most likely to be the star. You know, I'm not ever going to pick it, not going to pick anyone because of their, you know, because of where they come from. And it was interesting. I made this contention actually to the girls in the office, and I said, well, you know, challenge me on it. And we employed a girl who'd only literally moved to Australia the week we gave her a job from the US, but she'd been the PR director at Chanel in New York for about 4 or 5 years. We gave her a job on spec, essentially, and the girls challenged me and said, well, what about Annie? And Annie was fantastic, a smash. She's gone and had a baby and left us now. But she was brilliant in that she brought so many skills from that role, from the understanding of luxury brands and luxury brands PR, that were skills that we simply didn't have. So, you know, perhaps I was being mean.
Yeah, well, look, I'll tell you where I
as well as being mean to the
Well,
American.
Another, Tim, it's just at this point mentioned that the head of PR at Kellogg's, an account that you're pitching for, Gareth Lucy, yes. he's a pom.
And I bloody love Gareth. Let me just make that clear.
Yeah, yeah, right. I thought
he's one of the greatest.
We'll find out, because by the time this podcast goes up, we'll probably know either way whether you've got the gig or not. Ooh. So we'll find out then whether you love Gareth
or not. I haven't thought
this
through,
you?
Have I?
Yeah.
But he's brought some interesting new ideas. He's the idea behind the Twitter thing.
Which is worth explaining for those who don't know what it is.
Yeah, Kellogg's introduced the idea of looking for an agency via Twitter. So basically an agency could get on the pitch list if they're successful with a Twitter pitch.
I think what happened is they had five that pretty much sort of lined up, and I think we were in the original five because we didn't win the Twitter pitch, if you like. I think a Keep Left PR from Melbourne.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So what he did, and you know what he's, I you know, and obviously I'm going to say nice things about it this week. look, I think he was, what they did is, he brought an interesting approach to it. And I mean, look, fresh eyes, fresh ideas is great. I mean, I was just trying to, you know, let's be honest, I might have only had five. You came up, Tim, I'm talking to, came up with the six things, and I might have only had five, so I had to come up with the sixth. And so it was obviously easy to take some cheap shots at the
Always
poms.
Always overpromise. Well, yeah, and just on the, poms thing, I suppose where I'm always coming from with the question I was asking about, you know, different types of people and experiences, it's because I sometimes see it from the journalistic side, and I think of my own experiences where a few years back I literally went one day from being the editor of a magazine called Hospital Doctor to the next day being the editor of a magazine called Media Week. Now you might detect from the names those are very different specialist areas. So my employer had decided that my specialist skills as an editor were worth hiring in rather than the knowledge of the relationships and the subject matters. But I would say that just getting to understand the issues then took me a year. I would say it was a year before I was much use. I then moved to the Middle East. And on day one, I was able to look at a story and think, look, what this needs is a quote from a media planner. I didn't know who that media planner was, but I knew Mindshare would be there and they'd have a media planner so I could ring them up. So I was able to transfer into a completely new market. And because I had specialist knowledge from day one, I would say I was more used than when I moved within the same country.
Yeah, no, look, it may
Do you think it worked the same as for PR?
Look, I agree. I mean, I would be much more likely to employ someone who'd worked in luxury lifestyle brands in London than I would be to employ someone who worked on a healthcare account in Australia. Absolutely. So, I mean, we want to get that right. We're specialists in an area. I was just making a generalist comment about I tend to think media PR communication skills are less easy, not impossible, of course, because some of the best, you know, I mean, you look at the girl, Simone, who runs Mango, you know, she's a sensational person, but it does, even she'll admit, you know, those first few years are really tough building the sorts of relationships that you need in our industry to be a smash hit.
Do you think do you think journos make good PRs?
Well, I'm
as
one.
A former journo yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to say yes, and my wife's one as well, and she's now our sort of media and publicity director at Liquid Ideas. So I think sometimes they do. I don't think all of them do, but it's a really great – you know what? I still trawl contacts from 15 years ago that I had when I was working at the, you know, at News Limited. And they still come up handy because the people who I was a cadet with are now editors of magazines or they're, you know, sort of heading into senior management at various places. It's incredibly useful to be able to go back to the drink-a-thon at the Evening Star in 1988. It does help.
Well, the thing is, you are kind of a this sounds like I'm sucking up to you, but you're kind of a connected person in that there's a point where you just talk to everyone. And they're like, oh, yeah, I was out drinking with Stuart last night. Oh.
It's dry July, so no one's going to be drinking with me this month, and I'm letting a lot of people down.
Stuart, on the topic of journos and PRs, how have you seen that relationship evolve from when you were a journalist to now when you're on the other side?
I honestly have never had a problem with it. I mean, I might have been lucky, but I think I just – you carry the same sort of ethics and you carry the same sort of beliefs across the divide. There was a time when I – tried to do both, which I think was a bit cheeky. I was trying to be the gatekeeper as well as, you know, the storming the castle. But that was a bad metaphor, but I think you know what I mean. What are you, the poacher
Sometimes
and the gamekeeper?
The poacher and the gamekeeper. I like the gatekeeper.
The gatekeeper and storming the castle. I'm a bit of a jouster. I just bought a racehorse and we're going to call her Lady Jouster. which means nothing. But this is me just trying to obfuscate through a conversation that I'm struggling with detail. I reckon as long as you stay fair, dinkum, honest, truthful and trustworthy, I think the reason that we're where we are now is because the journos, and they are many of them, multitudinous, there are many more new people there than the old ones that I used to know. But as long as you take the same ethics through with you, which is you don't bullshit them, don't make stuff up, be fair dinkum, give honest answers as best as you can, and try to make yourself available. That's our ethos, I suppose.
Have you been tempted to go back to journalism?
No, there's no money in it. No. Look, to be honest, I was writing wine columns and books, and I've been keen. Yeah, I miss writing. I really do, and I would write something later on, but right now I love doing what I'm doing too much, because the business side of, I think one thing that journalists don't really understand that much when they come into PR is the exciting business side of it, and the relationships and the planning and the strategy. Journalism is wake up in the morning, and punch out a bunch of stories and then go to bed and then do it all again the next day, which has its enormous amount of excitement about it. But the strategic business planning, overarching stuff that we do in our agency, I really love. I probably didn't think I would. But I love it. So not really, but I often think I'd love to write a column, but I'm in PR. I'd have too many conflicts and I wouldn't be able to write the truth. So you don't do it. And I do think I have now firmly leapt over to the dark side, I think, as you people refer to it.
Now you touched on this question, measurement. In other words, how do you measure what a campaign is worth? I was in Cannes a couple of weeks back, where there was a PR category, which we might talk about as well. But one of the things there was, you still see lots of case studies saying, and we got $30 million worth of media free media exposure. This was one of the six things wrong with PR debates. Where do you sit? Do you happily tell your clients, I've just got you $40 million worth of space?
Well, it was on your website. I mean, it was on Umbrella yesterday, that
Tourism Queensland.
Tourism Queensland got $12 million.
Yeah.
I mean, In a philosophical sense, the fact that we judge ourselves by advertising's measurements, I just think is wrong, because if we're saying, well, we can be as good as advertising if we do this, is wrong. Also, it's so much more complex now, because if I tell you, if the Twitter campaign we do for Kellogg's, for instance, and we got 74 retweets and all these different influencers were tweeting about, because our little idea
Yours was a little joke.
Our little joke about breakfast without Kellogg's is like X without Y. So, people were saying Morecambe without Y's, and a few blue ones came up. There was a very funny one about spooning without something. Anyway, And that's immeasurable. So how do I go to a client and say that was worth $500,000? I can't do
so
it.
So how do you report back to clients?
Well, interestingly, literally in the last 2 weeks, I've been looking, subsequent to Umbrella 360, actually, I've been looking at the best measurement tools globally that we can get, and I found a thing called Vocus, which is used by a lot of PR companies in the US, and I've just bought it, but only two other PR businesses in Australia, I think, have invested in. It's quite expensive to buy the software platform to be able to get all the measurement and all the charts and analyze and analysis and that sort of stuff. So I just bought that a couple of weeks ago, and that's how we're going to be measuring going forward from August this year. I'm not entirely sure how it's going to work. I've got a couple of serious believers in my office who are going to take the lead, but we need to get share of voice, tone, and how people are talking about us. The social media measurement piece is still something that's interesting, and I'm talking to TribeCount and a whole bunch of different agencies about how we go about measuring that sort of thing, because as social media becomes more important, I mean, we can count, but so we can say it's had 326,000 views on YouTube, or it's had it's reached 250,000 people on Twitter. I mean, anyone can count. But I think counting and measurement are different things, and measuring effectiveness is something different. And the answer is, these Barcelona principles that they've got going in the Public Relations Institute, and they've just gone to Portugal, I think, just literally in the last couple of weeks. And I haven't actually kept up with what the PR industry as a whole is trying to do in order to create.
They do know that Barcelona's not in Portugal, don't they?
No, Barcelona was last year, and then Portugal was this year, I think. The Barcelona principles were 10 principles that the global PR industry came up upon last year. So I'm not that. It's the great imponderable Well, it's very ponderable, but it's unanswerable.
Are clients coming to you saying we want a million?
Sadly.
Oh, sorry about that. Are clients coming to you and saying we want this retweeted 400 times, we want a million YouTube hits?
Well, look,
can you press the go viral button,
please?
Well, we would like to. I mean, there's a bit of interest around. You know, we did that viral thing with Matt Moran, and there was a lot of interest in that.
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, let's talk about that. Yes.
I've
forgotten that was yours.
Yeah,
yes,
that was us.
Course, yeah. So this is the Matt Moran where the video popped up, and apparently it was a leaked piece of footage of him having a tantrum in
about food wastage
after apparently filming a segment for a commercial
or a TV cooking show. Yep.
But there was an evil plan behind it.
There was an evil plan behind it with only good intentions. And I think one of the reasons that it was, if we can call it successful, I think one of the only reasons that it was able to be accepted so well is because it had good intentions behind it. We weren't trying to sell a knife or some cooking equipment. We were basically trying to get...
Well, just before you explain who it was, we'll just play in a clip here.
A beautiful wrapped chicken with prosciutto, some autumn vegetables, a jus gras. Now, that's something I'd love to sit down right now and eat myself.
And cut. That was great, Matt.
Tail slate. Going again. And reset, please.
One second. Tail slate.
A little cutter on the left-hand side like I asked for in the previous page, mate. It'd be good. Yes. Thank you.
I've spent half an hour putting out a perfectly on a plate. You come along and you're throwing the fucking bin. Yeah, I don't care what you're fucking resetting. There's nothing wrong with that food. That's been wasteful. It could have fed one of these guys. Could have fed me. Get it out of the bin and put it back on the fucking plate. No, no way. You guys do it. No fucking way. There's nothing wrong with that food. How wasteful is that? You know, it's just
get it out.
Well, mate, if this is your job, you do fucking shoots like this all the time. You waste food like that. I don't want fucking anything to do with it. Get yourselves another chef. Now, piss off.
Nah. Right, so that was the clip. And who was the client? What was it actually for?
It was OzHarvest. So OzHarvest is an unbelievable organisation that we've been working for 3 years, where it's just about food recovery of perfectly good food and taking it to people who need it. And one of the things with OzHarvest, it was a simple issue we had, is that they can have their vans driving around the cities, but you know, in Orange or any part of regional rural Australia, it's just not possible to have a van there just collecting that food. So what OzHarvest had done is they pulled together a program of how people can do this in their country towns. And it was called REAP. And basically all we wanted to do is try to get that message out to as many people as we could, and said, if you're in a country town and you want to help get perfectly good food and feed it to people who need it more than, you know, rather than throwing it away, here's how you can do it. So we were launching the website. Matt Moran had done some stuff with us before. Great bloke. And I think you spotted him at the talking about OzHarvest, Tim, at the MasterChef launch.
That's right.
Which kind of twiggered. Hang on a minute. There might be a bit of a link here between OzHarvest and Matt Moran.
Because there was immediate speculation that maybe it was fake, wasn't there?
Well,
people didn't know what the cause was.
Semi-immediate. In these days, immediate. Like honestly, what we did, we were quite forensic about it. We had Melissa Leong, a particular food blogger, on a Tuesday morning, which we'd found was a reasonably high traffic time, to send one single tweet. And that's where it came from, one single tweet at about 9:30, 9:45, and saying, check this video out. Now, we thought that would have a lifespan of, I don't know, maybe 72 hours is what we were thinking. Well, within 4 hours, we were at hundreds of thousands. We had a current affair ringing us, and they were out the front of ARIA trying to find Matt. Right, Matt had been deliberately told that no phones, you know, because what we didn't want to do is lie. What we didn't want to do is tell people, oh, no, it's fair dinkum. And we didn't want to put Matt in a difficult position where people were saying, mate, you sound like a dick.
And was he nervous about doing that?
No, he was pretty he's incredibly good at doing that sort of thing. He'd been with OzHarvest. He's a guy from the bush as well, and he'd done that sort of thing with OzHarvest. If you meet Ronnie Khan, you know, you'll do anything for her. She's one of these amazingly charismatic. She was Australian of the Year, local hero last year. You'll do stuff for her. And he wasn't really. I think he kind of liked it, you know, and he turned his phone on at 2:30 that afternoon when we basically broke this, you know, we basically went out and fessed up at about 2:30, about the same time Mumbrella came out.
Yeah, I was disappointed you fessed up quite so soon. It would be nice if you'd held out for another hour or so.
Well, really, I think we had to be honest, because we had the news, we had pretty much all the major TV stations. We had this SMH running it as their lead article on SMH.com.
Because they bought it, didn't they?
They bought it lock, stock, and two smoking barrels. So, And My worry was that we needed to give particularly the news enough time to rejig their stories and go and talk to a couple of marketing people and get the whole, you know, they did a couple of vox pops saying, gee, what do you think of this? And what do you think of this if it were a stitch up? And we got exactly the right reaction.
And do you feel that you crossed any kind of ethical lines in terms of the fact that, you know, the Herald, for instance, ended up being hoaxed?
No, I think we walked a fine line. I think it would have been very difficult for us if this had been a campaign to sell Matt Moran's new pans. We would have been in serious strife. I think we played it short enough. You know, if people were to say, you know, if the Witchery guy and all that sort of stuff were to say that that's the hoax campaign of hoax campaigns, it just went on too long, and then they wanted to stick it up the media. We never wanted to stick it up the media. We never wanted to really make anyone look like a fool. What we wanted to do in the most impactful way with zero budget and is get the message out.
And was the Herald cross? Oh, sorry, go on.
Sorry, I was just wondering whether it's effective.
Yeah, that... you know what? It was yesterday we were talking, so it's probably, I'm going with about 6 or 8 weeks ago maybe, the campaign happened. 48 regional areas have had people starting up food recovery as a direct result of this. So it's, yes, you know, there are country towns now that are putting in place this sort of food recovery program that did not exist before that campaign.
And if anyone's wondering, those thumping noises.
Oh, sorry, that's me.
Stuart emphasising the point by banging the table. And just before we move on from Oz Harvest, was the Herald cross with you?
Don't know. You didn't hear from them.
And you've never
heard
from them.
Is the Herald always cross with you?
just back to the point about, I think that's how we got onto Oz Harvest, was clients approaching you about views. What was Oz Harvest's aim?
Did we
with
never
that?
Answer that question?
No, don't really think so. That's okay.
Their aim was just basically, we wanted to start a conversation, and you know what it did? Matt was on something like 40 radio programs over the next sort of 48 hours. Start a conversation about food wastage. Like, was he if people are throwing out perfectly good food, whether it's at a function, a cooking show, anything else, is that a reasonable thing to be doing? And the answer is no. And so that's we started a conversation with people, and radio talkback went berserk. You know, I remember I was driving to the airport, and Richard Glover was talking to Matt about it that afternoon. He was saying, remember your mum saying waste not, whatnot? There are people going hungry in country X who would love this food, eat it up. I think we're trying to regenerate that sort of mentality.
Would you know, funnily enough, we, a few
I
weeks
I cooked later, leftovers that yeah. night because I felt like I had
well,
to.
Well, a few weeks later, we found ourselves having our meeting with the Hilton before we put on Umbrella 360. Yeah. And I guess it had raised awareness for me because we thought to ask the question, what happens to the food we put on for the delegates afterwards? And in fact, they're part of Oz Harvest and they support it already. But it was the awareness that made me think to ask the question, you know, just
correct.
As a
and if,
you know,
mate, client. If people are asking the question, then, you know, most of the hospitality industry, most of the restaurants and deli guys are fantastic. And most of them do work with Oz Harvest. But what we want to do is take that national because it's probably a bit underdone in a couple of the other cities.
I'm not sure he's answered your question yet, though, Alice.
No,
yes, of
not
course, they come to us asking those sorts of questions, but we don't give them. We don't. It's very difficult to say this will hit a million.
Yeah.
Speaking of Alice, back to our. We're not going to get through all six of the six things wrong with PR. I think
no.
Alice Bans.
Yeah, Alice.
Explain that one.
Well, you know, in my desperate search for a headline, Tim, I actually whacked it out a real quick little and say, well, what's wrong? And one of my pet hates is that there's this. Term PR and a PR chick or PR girl, and I got in trouble for calling women girls as well. And I was saying that anyway, I think the quote was something along, if you've got an active Facebook profile, a VW golfer, flattened Paddington and an Alice band, you know, you can set up a PR business. And a few people caught on with that and it ended up being a few people tweeted it and a few people, I think it was put in the Australian media section. Look, it was just a bit of fun. Again, one of the issues that came out is, you know, PR as a term might be half of the problem. That, you know, when people think PR, they think Patsy and Adina. They think Ab Fab. They think
Samantha from Sex and the City.
Samantha from Sex and the City. They think publicity. And they think Bollinger and champagne and pretty girls and parties. And so we were, you know, and then there's marketing communications. And so one of the issues was just what is a publicist? What is a PR person and what is a communications professional? And that's sort of where we were coming from. And I was sort of saying that PR, has a bit of an issue that, you know, if a lot of pretty girls think I want to go into PR because it looks like so much fun. And it is fun, but it's not just putting on your Alice band in the morning and going off to a party in your Manolo Blahniks.
What do you
wish
like?
It was. I mean, I can't wear Manolo Blahniks too.
And what are you like when my face. when you're, you know, because you do put on events, you do manage events. Are you able to have fun when the event is going on?
Yeah, I mean, look,
do you get to enjoy it? Yeah. And the reason I ask this is you were kind enough to invite me along to the Bon Jovi gig, and I remember you racing up and down, and you looked like the most stressed man in the whole world.
It was a stressful night.
It was a very good event, by the way, but I wonder whether it was because of the stress you were putting into it.
Oh, look, it's like, I always say to the girls, it's like synchronized swimming. As long as everything above the surface looks pretty, it doesn't matter what the hell's happening underneath. So, you know, we have this, you know, if we are fighting and blueing out the back and because the catering is no good and, the people aren't turning up and all that sort of stuff, I don't care as long as we're all out there and the event itself's going great guns. That was an extraordinary event. I mean, that was probably the biggest party that Sydney threw last year. And, you know, we had a guest list of 1,200 people, all of whom had to have individual seats. So that becomes incredibly complicated when someone rings you on the day and says, you know, can I sit next to them? And it's like, well, no, because that means I have to shift about 1,000 people. But unless you're Russell Crowe, of course, or Tim Burrows.
I noticed I was sitting quite a lot further back than Russell Crowe.
At least you were down. Were you downstairs?
I was downstairs.
I had some complaints. Anyone who was upstairs. Anyway, look, the answer is, yeah, you have fun because you just love seeing it come off. If you get the thrill of seeing it come off, like I remember one stage, just using that Bon Jovi concert as an example, which was the Star City one-off private gig that Bon Jovi played. I turned around and it was Living on a Prayer, you know, and I just turned around and looked up at that Lyric Theatre at Star City. There were 1,800 people, every single person standing up, every right arm going up in the air, and every single person. They are ingrained. I'm not a Bon Jovi fan, but those lyrics are in your head somewhere, and they just spew forth.
And it was a very cool for school audience who wouldn't you wouldn't expect to be standing up for it.
It touched them.
As well.
And every there were CEOs there. There were, you know, people were telling me that they were standing behind some, you know, Nick Chan from Text or someone, and he was going bonkers, and Christy Hinds was down the front. She knew every word to every song, and she was like in the front row and reckons it's the best day of the. I think that's how she might have got pregnant. If you take it back, I think that's.
You heard it here first.
Yeah. Now, that was a bit indiscreet. we love Christy.
Now, another thing I touched on a little bit earlier was Cannes. There's been a PR category at the Cannes Lion for, gosh, I think only about three years now. We're yet to see a PR agency from Australia even get shortlisted for a Lion, partly because
we've never entered.
I'm sure there are some entries, but very few. Yeah. Far more from ad agencies. So we actually saw an Australian ad agency win the PR Grand Prix.
The NAB breakup campaign.
Yeah, the Clemenger BBDO, the NAB breakup campaign. What does that say about the PR industry that they here in Australia that they can't even get listed for a Lion?
Well, I think it says that properly integrated campaigns with a PR. It might say two things. It might say NAB was smart to enter it in PR because maybe the calibre of the calibre of the campaigns weren't as strong there. It's about, you know, the category you enter sometimes. I think it shows that campaign, all the elements of that campaign, you know, the public relations side of that campaign was unbelievably strong. It was a brilliant campaign. And I think it, to be honest, I mean, I don't think there are that many entries coming from Australia. You know, we don't have the resources in our business, like a little independent PR business, to spend the sort of time that is required to put a smoking hot presentation together to get noticed by a Cannes judge who might be doing 200 entries in a day, you know, and we don't have those resources. And I think a lot of the advertising agencies have got the resources and have been doing it for 20 years. I mean, Clemenger BBDO would have been entering Cannes for 20 years. They know what ticks boxes. It's like making wine for a wine show. They know how to draw attention, and they do a bloody great campaign.
Now, ad agencies, I think one of the ways they justify entering awards is they would argue it brings them business.
Of course, they would argue
it brings them staff.
Yeah.
Is it the same in PR? Do you think it influences people in the same way?
Oh, look, it could do, and I mean, it should do. I mean, I don't think it hurt us with that Mumbrella Award that we won a couple of years ago.
Yes, well, you are the reigning Mumbrella PR Agency of the Year.
And I hope you never have another competition.
As it's been about a good year and a half since we last did the Mumbrella Awards. So, the crown is still yours.
Look, and long may we reign. It attracts great stuff. I think we talked about it at one of those question times. I think it attracts stuff, but it does bring attention to your business and your work.
Can I just ask you, I mean, in creative agencies, awards are a real currency. Yeah. Creatives want awards. Yeah. They want to go to agencies that win awards. Mm. Does the same apply to PR agencies, do you think? Is it the same thirst for recognition?
Not really. It's never been a driving... it's never been part of mine, and I don't know if it's part of my staff's. I think the fact that we've only, you know, in Calm, we've only really been there for 3 years, and advertising agencies have probably been there since the 60s, shows that it's never been, maybe it will become that, but it's certainly not at the moment. It's never been a driving force of mine.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit more about some of the work that you've been working on. Carlton United Breweries, yeah, launching Strongbow Summer Pear Cider
in May.
Yes, in May. tell us about the strategy of launching a summer drink in winter.
Finding a slot, chasing a market share, and having a really good product. You know, and I think if you look at, you know, cider as a category, you know, we work across Bulmers, which is just sensational cider, and we work across Strongbow as well, and we're going to be doing some stuff with Mercury out of Tasmania. Cider's going gangbusters. I mean, we have finally, you know, every POM who's come to Australia in the last 20 years has said, oh, why isn't cider a bigger category here? Why aren't you drinking more cider? Well, it's finally happening. And we were talking about this summer having been the tipping point for cider. So the fact is, you know, Bulmers launched a pear cider, which has been going absolutely crazy, and it's a fantastic product. And I think there was a thought, well, Strongbow Pear, you know, if you can establish yourself a bit of a landmark, you know, in May, June, July, get all those listings in the retailers, you're in a really good position to be going strong in summer. And Strongbow this year, we have just been working a lot with a lot of great agencies in right across the country on Strongbow's summer campaign. And, you know, we'll have a much better chance with Strongbow Pear being established, being available, than we would if we were launching it in November, hoping that Liquorland, Coles would buy it, or hoping that Woolworths would range it. So it'll be there when the summer campaign starts.
Now, as an agency, you've grown a fair bit. I think about half a dozen new staff. Where is further? Yeah, where is the growth going to come from now? Is it going to be just more and more out of Sydney? Would you launch another office, you know, within Australia, elsewhere? Widen your sort of specialisation? What's the plan?
Well, I guess our specialisation, to answer that one, has broadened over the years anyway. I mean, we essentially started as a wine, you know, sort of drink specialist, and now we do food. We were always, from the day we started, we were lifestyle and leisure, and we've never changed from that. And I think, to be honest, in the foreseeable future, we will stay there. To answer the geographic question, there's been a fair bit of, we have two very large clients based in Melbourne, which is Craft and CUB, as well as Treasury Wine Estates, so the former wine arm of Foster's. There's been some talk of us opening in Melbourne. You know, we came from Melbourne, though. You know, like, I was 10 years in Melbourne, and the business actually started in Melbourne. I think we can probably manage those clients out of Sydney. I'd be more interested, and I'm just having trouble convincing some of my staff, I'd be more interested to look at another market, like maybe New Zealand or Asia, as a sort of mid to longer term.
And you can't convince yourself. They don't fancy.
They don't fancy New Zealand, and I think New Zealand would be fantastic. Look, I think I was talking to Simone at Mango, and they've got an office in Auckland that is just flourishing at the moment. So I like the idea of Auckland. In fact, I'm going to New Zealand twice towards the end of the year, so I think rather than just write it off as a rugby expense, I will pretend to be scouting for offices. And if the tax man's listening, that didn't happen. That's just been blanked out.
Next, the phone hacking scandal. Rupert Murdoch's News of the World is making its own headlines, and bad ones at that. Scotland Yard is investigating the paper's alleged interference with police investigations into the disappearance of missing schoolgirl Millie Dowler in 2002. There's also an Australian connection. So, Tim, you've been covering this one. Fill us in.
Yeah, and you may have noticed that just a couple of times already, I may have mentioned that I've just got back from Cannes. One of the benefits of that is wicked jet lag. So the last couple of days, I've been waking up at about 4 o'clock in the morning, or this morning, in fact, 2 a.m. A text message went off and I thought it was the alarm clock, so cheerfully got out of bed. But what that means is that I've been able to watch an awful lot of Sky News UK as the story unfolds in real time. And it's just been incredible watching this story that has been bubbling along for months suddenly has gone right to the top of the headlines. So for those who haven't been following, basically the News of the World used a number of private detectives to get hold of the private mobile numbers of celebrities, people in the news, and then found ways of getting hold of the PIN code to listen to voicemails. Sometimes it's because people, you know, often didn't even know they had to change the PIN code, so it was sort of on a factory setting. Sometimes they used even more nefarious ways to get hold of it. Now, this bubbled along and News of the World started paying compensation to various people. Generally, these were kind of rich, famous people, so the public weren't that outraged. It was a big story in a couple of titles, but not absolutely huge. The thing that's propelled the story right to all of the front pages in the UK, emergency debates in the House of Commons, you know, late this week, all of those things, is that it emerged that the newspaper hacked into the voicemail of a missing teenager, a girl called Millie Dowler, who, at the time she was missing, later proved that she'd actually been murdered. Now, not only did the paper hack the voicemails and, in fact, allegedly write a couple of stories about what they found, again, allegedly, they found that because the voicemail was filling up and they wanted to carry on listening to new things, they deleted some of the messages, which gave the family hope because they knew that somebody had deleted them and they thought maybe she was still alive, gave an interview to the newspaper talking about their hopes that she was alive. And that has been the real sort of hot button thing that, has outraged people. It's since emerged that victims of the London bombings again allegedly were hacked, that you know, a number of politicians were hacked. So it's become a huge story in the last few days in the UK, and actually become a global story. But the Australian connection, such as it is Crikey reported earlier this week that an executive at Fairfax Media is due to be questioned by the police about his time as news editor on the News of the World. Now, it was quite clear from that story they were referring to Ricky Sutton, who's the head of video. Ricky was actually news editor at the paper for a very short period, about 9 months, quite close to the time of the Millie Dowler thing, but not at the same time. So by the looks of it, he came along just afterwards. His successor as news editor, so the Millie Dowler period was about 2002. He was just after that. His successor has been arrested. That was some weeks back. So far, there's been, as far as anybody knows, no communication between the police and Ricky Sutton, and there's no suggestion that he knew of any wrongdoing himself. But clearly, you know, questions are, you know, you were present, what might have gone on. But it's worth stressing, there's no suggestion that he was involved in any of that activity himself. But at the same time, for Fairfax, clearly, you know, any sort of association with it isn't welcome.
The Australian connection's interesting. I just want, obviously, the British press has a bad reputation, always has done. This won't obviously do it any favours. What about the Australian connection, though? News Limited operations here in Australia. Will what's happened to the News of the World impact in any way Australian companies?
Look, I don't think it should. I'm an ex, you know, I'm a well known, you know, I'm a friend of a lot of, you know, good people at News Limited, and I'm an ex News Limited journalist myself.
And it's worth saying that News Limited is owned by News Corp, which also owns News of the World,
News International, and Sky. So it's interesting to hear that Sky are running this.
Sky have gone hard. To their credit, they went incredibly hard. You know, so credit to them. Part of the same family, but they went for it.
And I think you have to be aware of that within the Murdoch empire. You know, they're not afraid. You know, I was reading about it on the Oz website this morning. You know, so it's not like they're trying to bury this story. This is a legitimate story.
And Andrew Bolt has gone after it as well.
And in fact, I think it's fair to say that in a murky and often nefarious industry, which the British tabloids is, that has had significant low points over the years, this must surely be its lowest point. This is, I mean, if Rupert's come out overnight and said it's deplorable and all that sort of, it is one of those stories that actually hits you in the guts. It actually made me feel sick when I was listening to it driving home last night, and then having a look at a couple of the websites this morning. It actually made you feel ill to even be remotely related to it. And I can guarantee you that that News Limited people in Australia feel exactly that way. I cannot unequivocally say it, obviously, but knowing the people that I do across News Limited, that I cannot possibly believe that anything like this would be going on in Australia. I think that the people in Australia at News Corp would be as devastated as anyone to think that this could they could be tarred by this brush. This is the news of the world, and I mean its behaviour has been abominable, you know, and whoever's responsible for it has to go to jail. And you've got to remember that too, the royal bloke and
Clive Goodman, yes,
and the private eye have already got done jail time,
yes.
And you know you would find it difficult to believe that there aren't others who are going to go to jail, particularly if they find out that, as they have done overnight, that they're bribing police as well, paying the police off. So this is a dreadful story that has a long way to go, I think. And there was a fascinating interview on BBC with Hugh Grant the other day that I heard overnight, where he ripped into them and said, well, basically, you know, in a way, you know, he'd been banging on this for, because you know, they went to jail in 07, I think, those guys. This story's not been bubbling on for a couple of years, you know, for a couple of months. This story's been bubbling on for a couple of years. 07 or 08, they went
maybe
to jail.
Just a little bit more recently, but certainly years ago rather than months ago.
It's, you know, these guys, there's a lot more to go, I think, on this story. And I think the fact that it's this murder part of the story is just appalling. But then if they've done, you know, the stories overnight that the seven, you know, that some of the terrorists, some of the victims of the 7/7 bombing, they did a similar thing to, you know, someone's head's got a roll.
Well, I just wonder what sort of information they think they're going to get by tapping the phone of a bereaved or a potentially murdered child. I understand a politician or a celebrity, their phone being tapped, but I just wonder what sort of story they imagine they're going to get out of it. Well, why would they go to such lengths?
Trying to get leads. I mean, you know what it's about. I mean, it's ferociously competitive. They're also a Sunday paper. So the one thing that a Sunday paper needs, and if you've read the News of the World, like, you know, most of us do, it has to have half a dozen exclusives on that Sunday, every single Sunday. And they are ferocious. And what they're trying to get is something that the other papers don't have midweek, so they can smash it up on the Sunday. News of the World has done some, you know, they're undercover. You know, I mean, the News of the World is a bizarre place because they do some amazing things. Like, they busted open corruption in cricket, right? That was a fantastically important, you know, using some rather odd methods, you know, with that, what's his name? The undercover
Mazza
reporter.
Mahmood.
That undercover reporter, he has come up with
the fake shake.
The fake shake has come up with some of the great tabloid stories of the last 20 years. And yet they do this.
Well, the thing is, they, you know, the thing about News of the World stories is they stand up. They do turn out to be true. Mm. You know, that was always the thing, wasn't it? Sunday Times stories in the UK would usually fall over by Sunday afternoon, whereas News of the World stories, regardless of the methods, would usually stand up as true.
Yeah, look, and it's horrific, but I do not think that this should. Cast a shadow over the integrity of the people in News Corp.
In your journo days, did you ever do anything a bit cheeky?
Oh, you know, in my day, the way you got on, you know, if we're talking about murder stories, and that was death knocking, and the death knock was the most awful thing you ever did, which is literally knocking, for those who don't know, is knocking on the door of a family member of someone who's been murdered and trying to get a yarn.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a hell of a lot easier to hack into their mobile phone than it is to stand there at their front door and knock on their door and say, "Hello, Mrs. X. I know that your child has just been murdered. Would you mind talking to the Telegraph?"
Yeah, I remember talking to a son journalist who said on his first job, he was asked to go round to a lady's house whose son had just died. And he was briefed by his editor to try and steal a picture because they didn't have one. I mean, that sort of thing.
In a sense, Facebook has saved you the need to do that. I mean, you know, if you can just hack it, if you can just get into someone's Facebook page, you get the picture. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's awful. I mean, you know, I've been, you know, abused and, you know, told to F off in no uncertain way. But occasionally you do get access and you get remarkable stories. But, you know, there's a line. And I think one of the things is that the line here is a very differently positioned line to what it is over there and always has been.
Yeah. Do you think the situation after this story has broken will get better, or because of the circulation declines of newspapers, things would just get more desperate and potentially worse?
Well, one would hope the former rather than the latter. I mean, you have to hope that this will improve things. I mean, the simple fact is that Vauxhall and Ford have pulled all their advertising out of the News of the World. It will become, you know, it's already suffering some circulation issues. It's going to decline in advertising. You know, I mean, The one thing that some of these newspapers had going for them is the credibility of a proper organisation. You know, what you don't want are the bloggers, you know, the people with no journalistic training ripping into these sorts of stories. So it's really damaging for journalism, I suppose, and for media organisations. One of the few things they had in their arsenal was the fact that they could say, you know, we are proper journalists, we have a code of ethics, we will do this and won't do this. And this has just absolutely ripped that apart.
And just before we move on, it's worth noting that one of the other big advertisers was Vodafone for News of the World, which, you know, one would suspect they would struggle to support phone hacking.
One would think so, albeit Vodafone have their own issues. nothing as bad as that. But, I think they'll struggle. And I think the Murdoch, they have to learn from this. I you know, the News of the World's done some pretty dodgy things over the years, but this takes it to a hot new level.
Just a quick update on the phone hacking story. A few hours after recording this podcast, News Corp announced that it will be closing the News of the World. Now, on with the Mumbrella Cast.
So next, ANZ and Westpac launch new TV ads.
With more than 94.5 million active users globally, eBay is the world's largest online marketplace. Visit advertise.ebay.com.au.
So we've already touched on the fact that NAB did quite well at Cannes with the breakout campaign. Now, it seems that ANZ and Westpac are trying to get some of the attention with both releasing new TV ads. ANZ's features so-called Australian actor Simon Baker, who's become popular through his role in American TV series The Mentalist. Let's have a listen to the ad.
You know what? I know what you're thinking about banks anyway. You're thinking, life's moving fast. You want your life to be simple, cleverly simple. You're thinking you want to point and tap, and there it is. Bingo, you're plugged into everything anywhere in the region you want to be. You're thinking, I want my bank to be fully interactive, predictive, non-restrictive, even oddly addictive. You want it to be more human, more real. You're thinking, you want your bank to think outside your bank, to be creative, innovative, more in sync with you. And you know what? They're thinking the same way.
Now, Baker seems to be playing his character, Patrick Jane, who's particularly skilled in reading minds. There was also a parody ad released not too many days after this ad went to air, questioning why an Australian celebrity didn't have, you know, an Australian accent.
You know what? I know what you're thinking.
You're thinking, why is Simon Baker doing an American accent in an Australian ad? You're thinking, sure, he seems sincere. I mean, look, he's got an iPhone and a nice suit, but does he carry any more authority if we all pretend he was never in any street? You're thinking, okay, maybe he's playing a character. The Mentalist? The Guardian? Who can tell the difference? Was he in that Burn Notice show or Bones? You're thinking, does he even have a bank account here anymore in Australia or not? Does he bank with ANZ? And you know what? I don't even know what it stands for.
Meanwhile, over at Westpac, and their angle is We Know How, they're emphasising how they were the first bank in Australia.
When we opened Australia's first bank 194 years ago, we soon realised we were building much more than a bank. We were helping build Australia. Then, like now, every man and woman who's walked through our doors has had a dream. A dream to build a better life for themselves and their families. And we can't help but feel proud of the small part that we've played in helping many of those dreams come true. Australians have always known what they've wanted. That's the lesson our first customers taught us so many years ago. The future is yours if you know what you want and know how to get it.
Westpac, Australia's first bank.
We knew how then, we know how now.
Now, Robin, whenever we write about bank ads, they get absolutely slaughtered in the comment stream. Happened to Combank a lot as well. Damned if they do, damned if they don't.
Yeah, I think so. I think that we've seen a number of ads obviously released recently. Westpac, to be honest, I thought was fairly woeful. ANZ was a bit better, but flawed in the fact that what struck me was that Simon Baker never looked at the camera, and presumably a bank is all about gaining trust. And it seemed very shifty. But for me, far and away NAB stands out as a bank perhaps that differentiates itself, which I think is really important. Stuart?
Yeah, look, I think NAB succeeded in what it was trying to do, which is say we are different from the other banks and we were going to advertise differently and we're going to, you know, ANZ, I hate the ANZ. I'm sorry, but I don't hate the ANZ. I hate that campaign. Well, actually, I'm not that big a fan of the ANZ either, but to be honest. You know, but I think that, you know, the whole concept that paying a wealthy Australian in America to do a piece to camera where he doesn't quite look into the... I'm imagining that's how he is on The Mentalist. I'm imagining he's never looking to camera because he's the character and, you know, the camera isn't there. Simon Baker's a great bloke from Lennox Head who is doing an ad for Australia and New Zealand, presumably, and possibly Asia. Why he's talking that American accent, despite the fact I understand that he's a Mentalist, is just wrong. It's ill thought out, and I don't think it'll make anyone. I look at that ad and I go, am I going to spend some more money with the ANZ? Absolutely, unequivocally, no. I think NAB's a mile in front.
Alice, your favourite bank ad?
Favourite bank ad would actually have to be Bank West. I like all their little gibbering little ponies, and I actually started banking with Bank West because of, well, what they had to offer, but because I like their ads, I like their approach. When
see,
they
I thought
started.
Though they were saying our customers are on drugs and they're seeing imaginary creatures.
Well, maybe they are. That's how you get the youth market. You
know? Yeah, well.
No, a clever challenger brand sort of strategy. Yeah, yeah. But ANZ, I reckon, have had a bit of a shocker.
Well, next, Reality Bites. 10, 7 and 9 continue the ratings race.
You're listening to the Mumbrella Cast. For more on all these stories, visit mumbrella.com.au. It's getting to the interesting end of MasterChef, and Australia's Got Talent, where the best contestants are showing their true colours. Over at Nine, the block has begun to find its feet, with episodes pulling in around 1.3 million. MasterChef has been continuing its stronghold on most weeknights, with most people tuning in. On Thursday night, we saw contestant Matt Bayer booted off the show for using his smartphone to source recipes. This episode saw an audience of 1.7 million, despite the competition of State of Origin, which rated a whopping 2.5 million for 9. Still on 10, we saw the debut of Can of Worms on Monday night. Its audience was under 1,930,000. So, Alice, what do you think of the show, Can of Worms?
I think it lacked the punch that it needed to actually be effective. They were doing a lot of marketing for it, and the way with all the vox pops on people on the street, it came across that it was going to be quite controversial.
Yeah.
For those who haven't seen it, and I kept myself in that, I don't know if I mentioned that I was abroad at the time.
Where was that? Where were you?
maybe explain the... Play a little ding each time. maybe explain the format.
Basically they put some politically incorrect scenarios and questions to a panel of celebrities, as well as the audience, and as well they also poll online, and they can only answer yes and no. There's no sitting on the fence, and they have to explain why they feel that way. Now, I thought there could have been a lot more questions that could have been on the agenda for a first show to say, hey, here we are, let's be controversial. You know, people want this, supposedly. That's what, you know, they're going for. We're going to get Australia talking. But looking at the Twitter stream, everyone was talking in a tone that perhaps that 10 wouldn't find too favourable, because it lacked that oomph, I guess.
Stuart, do you agree? Do you think that perhaps the positioning of the show didn't match the show itself?
Yeah, I'm with them. I don't have the excuse of can, but I have the excuse of work, I think, for not having seen Can of Worms. But I have spoken to quite a few of my family, as well as people in the office, said exactly the same thing. Said that it was, you know, it may have overpromised and underdelivered. Mm-hmm. You know, all of the PR before it and all of the advertising before it suggested that this was really going to rock the boat.
Yeah.
And I'm with you. I think maybe they really needed to, you know, put a stake in the sand and push the first episode to really get the controversy going, to really sort of drag it up. But that said, they're a pretty good production company.
That's
they'll come
the thing,
good.
Isn't
they'll
it?
Come good, I reckon. And they're clever enough to be refining this as we speak.
Zapruder are the people behind things like the Groom Transfer.
They are smart enough. I reckon they'll nail it in a couple of weeks. And again, there'll be enough issues for them to start, you know, getting a bit meaty. First show difficult. But I'm impressed by The Block, not by its numbers. I didn't think The Block at 7 o'clock would rate those sorts of numbers every night of the week, and you know, being a rehashed format and all that sort of stuff. But I'm amazed at those sorts of numbers, and to see MasterChef get 1.7. On the same night as State of Origin.
Very respectable number.
That is a sensational number, considering every single decent-minded New South Welsh or Queensland person would have been watching Origin. Although they didn't really cross over, because we had our two televisions in our house going on both, and MasterChef pretty much finished just, you know, only 15 minutes around kickoff, off after kickoff, by which time New South Wales was 14-0 down.
Yeah. And I'll just add it's a script error on my behalf.
Script error on my IT responsibility.
Oh,
yes.
Okay. We said Thursday night contestant Matt Bayer left, but it was actually Wednesday night. Yeah. So.
All right. So just to go on Can of Worms, one show that I've seen that did live up to the marketing hype was Go Back to Where You Came From on SBS, which I thought was phenomenal. But Tim, reality show overload at the moment.
We keep saying that, and then a good show comes along. You know, we said that before MasterChef. Loads of people said, you know, another cooking show? No, there's just not room for it. And then it was a huge hit, and everyone kind of post-rationalised and said, oh, it's because people are cocooning and they like people to be seen to do well. Nobody said any of that before it came along. So there's not an overload. It's good shows, regardless. Those are the ones that break through. With The Renovators, which is Ten's next one, we'll have to see. We'll probably be talking about that next week.
Yeah, but also with MasterChef, people underestimate the production on that show is so fantastic. Like, they have produced their brains out on that show. And I can tell you what, this New York week, you know, I just saw Matt Preston was in our office yesterday. This New York week is going to be a spectacular.
So why
the
was
numbers
Matt
are going to go crazy, so what, I reckon.
Why was Matt Preston in your office?
He was just popped in. Our office is around the corner from the MasterChef kitchen, so we see a little bit of him. But he was having a bit of a massage. I think he's got a bit of a crooked back, and the best back masseur in Australia happens to be in the office right next to us, which is very, very good. So if we ever move office, I'm taking this bloke with me. Bill.
That is all we have time for today, unfortunately. A big thank you to Liquid Ideas' Stuart Greger.
Thanks for having me, team.
To Mumbrella's Robin Hicks.
Cheers, Tim.
And to Alice Telikovsky.
Thanks, Tim.
The Mumbrella cast was recorded at the studios of CBS Interactive. See you next week. Toodle-pip.